The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606. Today's broadcast is made possible with support from Radio Maria, featuring an international brunch, lunch, and dinner menu influenced by Caribbean, Asian, Indian, Spanish, and Latin cuisines. Radio Maria in downtown Champaign, a restaurant of unusual sensibilities. Programming on WILL is made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, welcoming the new energy of musicians Laurie Anderson and Bang on a Can All-Stars, dancers Rennie Harris and Ralph Lemon, and the theatrical productions Forbidden Christmas and Aladdin during the 2004-2005 performance season. For more information, visit KrannertCenter.com.
Good morning. Welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. Producing the show, Harriet Williamson, Travis Stansel, Henry Frayne is at the controls. A word or two about the programs we have scheduled for Monday. In the 10 o'clock hour, Dr. Suzanne Troopen will be with us. She is an obstetrician and gynecologist. She also teaches the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign, and once a month, and it's generally on a Monday, she is with us, and we talk about women's health. You're certainly welcome to call in and talk about anything that falls within her area of practice, and usually she also comes prepared to talk about a few things that are new. So that will be what we'll be doing in the first hour on Monday. In the second part of the show, we'll be talking a little bit about the history of a recent device. It's something that has come to be one of those indispensables of modern life, and that is the copy machine. Our guest for the show in the 11 o'clock hour on Monday will be David Owen. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. And he's written a book all about a man and his life, a man named Chester Carlson, and his efforts to find a way to reproduce documents. This is the man behind the Xerox machine, and he has written, that is the guest that we'll be talking with, David Owen, has written a book titled Copies in Seconds. The subtitle is How a Lone Inventor and an Unknown Company Created the Biggest Communication Breakthrough Since Gutenberg, Chester Carlson and the Birth of the Xerox Machine. So that'll be Monday in the 11 o'clock hour. And we are here weekday mornings from 10 until noon. We have 10 different topics for you every week and always give you the opportunity to call in with questions and comments. In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking about a little bit about American history and looking back to the Civil War. And chances are when you go out and you ask people to tell you about the Civil War and you ask them a question like, well, what was the Civil War all about? They will say correctly that it was about slavery. And that while that is true this morning in this part of the show, we'll be talking about how slavery played a role in the war and perhaps in a slightly different way than most people think about. Our guest for the show is Michael Holt. He's professor of history at University of Virginia, has authored a number of books, including a recent one that's titled The Fate of Their Country, Politicians, Slavery Extension, and the Coming of the Civil War. It's published by Hill and Wang. And in the book, he makes the argument that while the Civil War was indeed about slavery, it perhaps wasn't quite as much about slavery in the places where it already existed as it was about slavery where it did not. And so the issue that we'd be talking about primarily is the kind of debate that happened in the Congress and in Washington leading up to the war about the issue of slavery extension and the West. And in those days, the West was anything on the western side of the Mississippi River. He explains that in the book, something that he's written a lot about in other books that perhaps are mostly for historians. This is one, he says, it's more for a general audience, and explores the way that politics, pure partisan politics, can sometimes have very dramatic and sweeping consequences, like war, for example. As we talk, certainly questions are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free 800-222-WILL. Professor Holt, hello.
Good morning.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us today.
I'm delighted to be here.
I certainly appreciate it. As you explain in the book now, that it apparently is the consensus among historians that the question of slavery extension significantly aggravated tensions between the North and South and helped pave the way to war. And the big question perhaps is, why is it that it was such a big issue? And I think you note that it was not because it was an issue that the public was particularly exercised about. It wasn't that many American people either wanted slavery in the West or didn't want slavery in the West. It was an issue for politicians, especially members of Congress. And because of that, it then became a national issue, not the other way around.
That's true. Certainly the argument in the book is that this slavery extension issue arose not because of any spontaneous grassroots pressure from one side or the other to extend slavery or even get extend the territorial boundaries of the United States, that these were political decisions, and almost as soon as the question of territorial expansion came up, the question of slavery extension followed it, and that divided the country much more than the question of slavery itself. And certainly that's true in the North. The abolitionists who were calling for extirpation of the institution were a small minority of the Northern population, but the idea that slavery would extend into the West and particularly into areas that had been dedicated to free soil, or from which slavery had previously been prevented or barred, really did anger a lot of Northerners.
Mm-hmm. And I guess too, we should make the point, as you also do in the book, that we're not slavery extension, and the debate over slavery extension didn't cause the war, but what it did was it just. The words you use, it intensified the animosity between the North and the South. It helped to lay the groundwork, but it maybe wasn't the thing that caused the war.
Well, yes and no on that. When I teach my course on the coming of the Civil War, I always tell students that we can count backwards. There wouldn't have been a firing on Fort Sumter without secession of the Deep South states. There wouldn't have been secession of the Deep South states without the election of Abraham Lincoln as president. That's what triggered secession. There wouldn't have been the election of Lincoln as president without the formation of the Republican Party, and the Republican Party wouldn't have been formed without prior events. And it's that argument about slavery extension that is directly responsible for the formation of the Republican Party. Hmm. So this issue does play a role, I think, in explaining the sequence of events that led to the outbreak of war in 1861.
Well, let's go back a number of years, as you do, and talk first about the Missouri Compromise. At the time here in Congress, they were very concerned with the balance of power between free states and slave states. The Northerners didn't want Missouri to come in as a slave state, and the Southerners did. And eventually they solved this by admitting another state, Maine, as a free state, so that balance between the slave states and the free states could stay as it was.
That is correct. But there was an even more important part of the so-called Missouri Compromise.
Right.
And this was to take what was the remainder of the Louisiana Purchase Territory, going all the way up to the from the Rocky Mountains to the Mississippi and up to the 49th parallel, and say that all the land north of the parallel 3630, which happened to be the southern boundary of the state of Missouri, that slavery would be forever prohibited from all the land north of that line within the Louisiana Territory.
And I guess what's significant is you point out that that at that time, we were talking about 1820, most of the Southerners in Congress, at least almost all of the Southern senators, I think all except two, and in the House about half of the Southern representatives actually voted for this.
Well, they did. The votes were a bit different. In In the Senate, the main Missouri and 3630 line were all combined in a single bill, and Southern senators voted for that bill 20-2. Northern senators voted against it 18-4, so it passed 24-20. And Southerners voted for it, obviously, in order to get Missouri as another slave state at the cost of this prohibition elsewhere. In the House, as is well known, where Henry Clay was Speaker, and this is the first place that Clay performs as the Great Compromiser, Clay realized there weren't enough votes because Northerners were still so angry about this to get the package through. And therefore he divided into separate votes the Maine and Missouri package and the 3630 line. And Northerners voted unanimously for the 3630 line. Southerners divided 39-37. It was a very close division in the House. At this time, and notice I'm speaking only about Southerners and Northerners here, what had been the so-called first two-party system of Federalists and Jeffersonians had effectively collapsed. The Federalist Party was discredited. So there were no organized parties in either the Senate or the House during these debates.
Well, that gets us into the theme of partisanship, I guess, and the difference between what happened with the Missouri Compromise, which when you look at the rivalries here, it seemed to be basically to be sectional.
That is
North and South. When you get into some of the later conflicts, particularly now the question of Texas, here it seems that, and then what happens from that forward, that partisan rivalries, and I think you make the argument that individual politicians who have in mind rather short-term partisan goals, and that may in fact just at the end of the day just mean their reelection, becomes more powerful in a way that it hadn't before. And here I guess I quickly start myself to feel a little bit confused about the various rivalries, because not only do we have tension and sort of rivalries between the two parties, which in this case would be the Democrats and the Whigs, but even within the parties, there are people who have very different ideas, and on this basic question of slavery and when new territory becomes added to the United States, what's it going to be? Is it going to be free? Is it going to be slave?
Well, this is true. Although, and both parties, as a general rule, sort of agreed to disagree between their northern and southern wings about slavery issues until specific issues came up. And what was most interesting about the events in the 40s, which involved the territorial expansion of slavery, both with the acquisition of Texas and then with the Mexican War, was that these did become party rather than sectional divisions. Now, there is a real reason for this. One has to go back with Texas annexation to the administration of a nominal Whig named John Tyler, who'd been elected vice president in 1840 and succeeded to the presidency a month after his running mate, William Henry Harrison. This is the Tippecanoe and Tyler II ticket. Harrison died within a month of his inauguration. Tyler came in. He almost immediately vetoed legislation. The Whigs, for the first time, had control of both the House and the Senate. The Whigs passed legislation they considered vital. Tyler vetoed a lot of these bills. His cabinet all resigned. Whig members of Congress literally went out onto the steps of the Capitol and read a paper reading Tyler out of the Whig Party. Tyler, in seeking an issue to win as a sort of independent candidate, he wanted to run again in 1844, came up with the idea of annexing Texas, which had fought a war for independence from Mexico in 1836, set up as a separate republic, although Mexico never recognized the independence of that republic. But Tyler worked out a treaty of annexation. Virtually all Whigs were going to oppose any initiative that came from Tyler, and the Whig presidential candidate that year, who happened again to be Henry Clay, came out in a public letter against immediate annexation. And so did the presumptive Democratic nominee, who was going to be Martin Van Buren. But Van Buren's opposition to immediate Texas annexation was used by elements that were hostile to Van Buren's nomination to dump him, to stop him from getting the nomination. And instead, the Democrats nominated James K. Polk of Tennessee on a platform demanding the immediate annexation of Texas and what they called the immediate reoccupation of Oregon as well. So that Texas annexation became very much a partisan issue during the campaign. Tyler's treaty in the Senate in June of 1844 was defeated by almost a two-thirds majority because a lot of Northern Democrats loyal to Van Buren were so furious that he'd been denied the nomination that they voted against the treaty. But Texas annexation was very much a party issue by then, and when it was finally accomplished in the votes in Congress in the winter of 1844-45, the party lines were really stark. I mean, in the final vote in the House of Representatives, every single Democrat voted for Texas annexation. All Whigs but one voted against it. That's about as a stark a party line as you'll ever come up with. And then territorial expansion remained a partisan issue because Polk, on his own, I have a line in my preface that the Mexican War is probably the closest to the Iraq War of any war in American history, and I think it is. It's because Polk on his own decides that he wants to get California, which is a Mexican possession. We know this. He writes it in his diary before he's even inaugurated. He tries to buy California from Mexico. They refuse, so he provokes a war. He uses his power as commander-in-chief to send troops down to the northern and eastern banks of the Rio Grande River. There was a dispute as to whether the Rio Grande or the Nueces River marked the dividing line between Mexico and Texas. He insisted it was the Rio Grande. These troops are perceived as invaders by Mexicans. They attack the army. Polk then goes to Congress and says war has begun by an attack of the Mexicans. And the war has started. Well, Whigs were infuriated by this, and therefore opposition to the war itself was a partisan issue. There were the Democrats defended the war, Whigs opposed the war, and when the question of territorial annexation from Mexico, what would end up in the Mexican cession, was first raised, and this was raised immediately, in the summer of 1846, Whigs adopted a position they called no territory, that the United States should take no territory from Mexico as a result of this war, and Democrats insisted that there should be a territorial acquisition. Hmm. And it was in arguing about that potential territorial acquisition that the question of slavery extension itself really came up in what would remain its most divisive form right up to the Civil War.
And you, Ed, as you mentioned, there was this very stark division of opinion on annexation of Texas between the two parties, the Whigs and the Democrats. And the Whigs mostly opposed it, and the Democrats favored it. The thing that we haven't mentioned, that the wrinkle here, the thing that makes this difficult, is that in the Republic of Texas, slavery was legal. It existed.
That is correct.
And so when you look at the positions that the Whigs and the Democrats took on annexation of Texas, was that in effect a position on slavery?
Well, obviously it was not for Northern Democrats. Who went along with annexation, and not because they wanted to add another slave state. It had become a partisan issue, except for Northern Democrats loyal to Martin Van Buren. Many Northern Whigs, openly opposed Texas annexation because they didn't want to add more slave territory to the country. Southern Whigs are much more interesting here because they too oppose Texas annexation. They too oppose taking any territory from Mexico once that war starts. And I think there are at least three reasons that explain this Southern Whig position. That is, they seemingly are voting against the interests of the South if the interest of the South is to get more territory for slavery. One reason is that they were very determined to maintain harmony with the northern wing of the Whig Party so that they could cooperate on governmental economic policies. A second is that Southern Whigs in 1844 certainly argued that annexation of Texas was bound to lead to war with Mexico, and the only way to avert war with Mexico was to not annex Texas. And third, they and Clay and other Southern Whigs repeatedly cited, Northerners don't want this. This is going to aggravate sectional relations. It's going to worsen relations between the North and the South if we do this. It's not worth it. Just let Texas remain an independent republic.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580, Michael Holt, teaches history at the University of Virginia. He is the author of a number of books, including The Rise and Fall of the American Whig Party, and also a book that is out more recently that looks at the issue of slavery extension in the West and how that contributed to the Civil War. The book is titled Fate of Their Country, and it's published by Hill and Wang. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. As you have explained, we have here at this time the president is James Knox Polk. He's a Southern Democrat. He's also a slaveholder and a man who has this very expansionist kind of idea about the West. He wanted Texas. He wanted California. He provoked a war with Mexico so he could say to the Congress they started it, so he could have as much of Texas as he possibly could get. And then after the war, he still was hoping that what he could do was work out a kind of a deal with Mexico for California, and went to the Congress and said, well, will you give me some money? I think the figure was $2 million. Which I'm sure in those days was some real money. Would you give me some money, and then I can work out a deal where essentially I can buy California from the Mexicans. And here we come to the Wilmot Proviso, named after a congressman from Pennsylvania who we probably never would have heard of except for this, who offered an amendment saying, okay, you can have your $2 million, but any territory that comes into the United States as a result of this has got to be free.
That's absolutely correct. The 2 points here. It's very important to note that Mexico had abolished slavery, so that slavery wasn't legal in any Mexicans on any Mexican soil to which Polk. For which Polk lusted, and many Northerners thought it was simply outrageous to introduce slavery into an area if it was annexed from which it had been abolished or prohibited. But it's very interesting that Wilmot is a Northern Democrat who introduces this proviso. And the Wilmot proviso, as I explain in the book, polarized both the House and the Senate along sectional rather than along party lines. Mm-hmm. The war and expansion from it was a partisan issue, but this Wilmot proviso, which would have prohibited slavery from any territory taken from Mexico, was really a naked sectional issue. And one of the reasons that Wilmot introduced this is that Northern Democrats had been warning as soon as Texas was annexed that it would be disastrous politically for Northern Democrats if a war was started that Northern Whigs could say was being fought in order to extend slavery. So one of the reasons for the introduction of this proviso was defensive, that is to let Northern Democrats reassure their constituents that they weren't supporting, they were supporting a war for territorial expansion but not for slavery expansion. The other reason that Northern Democrats in the House and the Senate supported this unanimously, along with Northern Whigs, was that Polk had simply outraged a number of Northern Democrats on different issues. The way that Texas was ultimately annexed was seen as a betrayal of a promise by certain Northern Democrats. The deal he worked out in the Treaty of 1846 to divide the Oregon country with Britain at the 49th parallel was seen as a betrayal by many Midwestern Democrats. A lot of Northern Democrats were angry with Polk, and this was a sort of act of revenge. But clearly, the Wilmot Proviso was never passed, but it kept getting reintroduced, and this issue wouldn't be settled until the Compromise of 1850. The reason that Northern Democrats and Northern Whigs kept supporting it was that the public opinion in the North clearly was against allowing the extension of slavery into any new lands. What is also interesting is, you know, but your listeners won't, because I mentioned it in the book, is that this polarization appears in the summer of 1846, it's August of 1846, 3 months after the war has started. Northerners and Southerners in Congress are fighting over the Wilmot Proviso for 2 years before there's any actual territorial acquisition. I mean, it's a highly, it's an entirely theoretical issue, but it does split Northerners and Southerners over this. And then the question is why? Why would the politicians, and here the evidence is that the public in both sections was really agitated about this issue, and why would they care about it so much? And I think there's several reasons for this. You have to do it, look at each section separately. We know that a number of Northerners believed, and especially Northern farmers, believed that free labor or free farmers could not compete with slaveholders in the same area. And therefore, if slavery went in to an area, free farmers from the North would be effectively prohibited from going into it. We know, because the evidence of this is simply overwhelming, that a lot of Northerners, any Northerners who were morally opposed to slavery, who considered the institution a sin, just believed it was unconscionable to allow its further extension. And some of those, like Abraham Lincoln, believed that if slavery could be prohibited from expanding geographically, that ultimately Southerners themselves would one day free the slaves, manumit the slaves voluntarily as the institution used up the land and was no longer economically viable. This is in Lincoln's famous phrase, putting slavery on the road to ultimate extinction. But there was also people who in the North who were very clear about they didn't want any more slave territory added because slave territory would produce slave states, and they were tired of the South running the national government. They wanted to prevent any growth in the political power of the South. And finally, and we tend to forget this, the evidence is very clear that a lot of Northern opposition to slavery extension was racist. The objective was to keep blacks out of the territories, to preserve the West entirely for white men, and it was believed that the most likely way blacks would get into the West was to be carried there as slaves, and hence, to keep blacks out of the West, you want to keep slaves out of the West. Those are the sort of congeries of motivations behind the Northern opinion. Southerners were, well, and in some ways, the Southern reactions were the mirror image, although here one has to differentiate between Southern Whigs and Southern Democrats. Many Southerners, but especially Southern Democrats, feared, well, if slavery's not allowed in the territories, and if we annex more territories, eventually those free territories are going to produce more free states. The balance in the Senate between the North and the South is going to be upset. Eventually there'll be so many additional free states that the North will try to amend United States Constitution to abolish slavery in the South, and therefore to prevent more free states from coming in from the West. Southerners insisted that slavery be allowed to extend to those territories. A few, a very few, and again, I think almost all Democrats actually believed that slavery could prove economically viable in what would become the Mexican Cession. People who'd been in what New Mexico and what became Arizona didn't believe this for a minute, but some people believe that slavery could actually be carried there. But it seems to me what most united Southerners and Southern Whigs, I should say, unlike Southern Democrats, never believed that slavery could exist, economically viable in any of the territories that people were arguing over after Texas was annexed. Neither the Mexican Cession nor later Kansas and Nebraska. They just thought this was a phony issue that was used to whip up Southern anger. But Southern Whigs had to go along with opposition to the Wilmot Proviso because virtually every Southerner saw this in kind of symbolic terms as a that this Northern demand or an attempt by the Northern majority in Congress, or at least in the House, to bar, prohibit slaveholders from common territories was insulting. It was treating Southerners as inferior, and the language of Southern protests against the Wilmot Proviso just ring with terms emphasizing how derogatory it was, how humiliating, what an insult to Southern honor this attempt by Northerners to say to Southerners that they weren't equal of the Northerners. They would say, well, if Northerners can take their cattle and horses into this territory, why can't we take our property? If we're not given equal property rights in the territories, then we're being treated as less than equal. We are being treated, and this was the term they used, and the rhetoric of this period, again, is filled with this. We're being treated as slaves. We're going to be reduced to political slaves, to Northern domination, if we allow the North to prevent the institution of slavery from being carried into the West.
We have a couple of callers here who would like to join in the conversation. Let's do that.
I'll try to keep my answers shorter.
On this program, we appreciate thoughtful and thorough answers, so I have no problem with that. We'll go here to a caller in Indiana on our toll-free line, right here, line 4. Hello.
Hello. Sort of took me back a long time, history courses I took, and honestly, I think the moralistic thing was pushed more than anything. But I guess intuitively the first thing that came to my mind is Charles Beard's history of the United States and the economic part of it. And I seem to get that from this minutia you've been going into, that that's more important than anything else, plus the rancor between the parties themselves. Since I don't know a lot about it in that sense, I'd like for you, if you could, sketch the opposition and why you think they're wrong, if you already haven't done that in this last half hour, but sort of, you know, bring us up to date what's actually going on in the scholarly world.
Oh, you want what we call historiography. I've been making this argument. In some ways, this new little book of mine is a distillation of two previous books, and I've been making this argument about the political origins of the issue and politicians' responsibility for the issue. I first made the argument in a book that came out in 1978. And not everybody agrees with this point of view at all. For example, argue that the real basis of Northern opposition to slavery extension was primarily economic. That it was what I mentioned briefly, this fear that a free labor system and free farmers couldn't compete with slaveholders, and therefore that if slaveholders were allowed to go into any disputed territory, free laborers and free farmers would be prevented from going there. And therefore, essentially, the North would be kept out of the West. Some do argue, although not many people anymore, do stress more than I do the depth of moral antipathy to slavery in the North is motivating Northern opposition to slavery extension. This is certainly true of somebody like Lincoln, for example. If you get to the Lincoln-Douglas debates and later on, he was deeply motivated by moral antipathy to slavery, although not enough to call for its immediate abolition. Others, let me turn to the South, where I tend to see Southern resentment of Northern attempts to prevent slavery extension largely in terms of honor and in symbolic terms, this sense of insult and indignation about being dishonored by the North. Real concerns about Southern slaveholders Southern slaveholders about the strength of slavery on the South's periphery. The argument is that slaveholders in South Carolina and other eastern Deep South states are trying to build up the strength of slavery on the periphery of the South in places like Missouri and Texas. And so that those areas don't voluntarily manumit their slaves. They want to strengthen slavery as an institution on the periphery of the South to protect themselves at the core of the South. So, there are different opinions. I shouldn't say that. It's interesting that you mentioned the Beards. Because for a long time, their economic interpretation that the Civil War was fought over tariffs or disagreements about national governmental economic policy, it's been kind of laughed off. But I know now of at least three recent or ongoing efforts to revive an economic interpretation of the Civil War. One in a book that just came out called Calculating the Value of the Union by an historian named James Houston, who actually got his PhD at the University of Illinois, is based on simply the property value of slaves and the determination of slaveholders to defend the value of those slaves as assets is what was driving the conflict. And with regard to the slavery extension issue here, the argument would be that the value of slaves depended on the market price of slaves. The market price of slaves depended on demand. Demand depended on the future usability of slaves and the productivity of slaves, and therefore anything that might drive down demand, such as the closing off of the West to slavery extension, would drive down prices, and therefore to protect the price of their assets, slaveholders demanded on the right to carry slaves into the West. That, as I said, is a recent economic interpretation of the Civil War based largely on the South. But there's another fellow up in Canada who's been working on a book for several years whose argument is that what changed in the dynamics and brought on the Civil War economically was primarily the growth of the Great Lakes states, of the Midwest, and particularly the areas of the Midwest on the Great Lakes, that fundamentally altered the sectional balance of political and economic power, and that's the economic explanation for the war. So, you know, in the last 40 years or 50 years, most people discounted the Beard's economic interpretation. In the last two or three, it's making a big comeback, although not in the Beardian version of it.
Right, let's talk with someone else. We have a caller here on a cell phone on our line one. Hello.
Yes, I just wanted to touch upon the fact that every advanced country going against England had to have a tariff, and to get the industrialized machine going, the tariff is a very important issue, along with the emotional issue, the fact that the free labor, I think the economic leaders of this country, or at least the powerhouses in the Senate, who are often millionaires, and determined that without if the tariff was put against England, then cotton would be ruined and slavery would be ruined. So I'd like to hear your comments on that. Thank you.
Well, that's certainly that's interesting. We can go back to an incident that I don't really talk about in this new little book of mine, but the nullification crisis during the presidency of Andrew Jackson, which was sparked by high tariffs in 1828 and again in 1832, which South Carolinians argued was damaging their economy. And, of course, South Carolina eventually passes a proclamation to nullify these tariffs, to refuse to allow them to be collected in the ports of South Carolina, and the so-called Compromise of 1833 is worked out in Congress to resolve this crisis. But the argument of at least South Carolina cotton growers was that because England was the biggest market for Southern cotton, any high tariff that would diminish English exports of textile goods to the United States would reduce British demand for cotton, for raw cotton, and thereby drive the price down and directly hurt Southern cotton growers. The nullification crisis, interestingly enough, occurred in a period where there still wasn't a fixed two-party system. It occurred before the formation of the Whig Party. The Whig Party was committed to high protective tariffs, and Southern Whigs supported those tariffs. They didn't get a chance to pass one until 1842, and when the Democrats regained control of Congress in 1846, they passed a much lower tariff, and we had a low tariff policy going up until the Civil War. So the old argument of the Beards is that Southern resentment of high tariffs is what caused Southern secession in the Civil War just holds no water at all, because the tariffs from 1846 up into the war were very low.
Well, we're coming down to our last maybe 7 or 8 minutes, and there's one thing I want to make sure that I have you talk at least a little bit about, and that is the Kansas-Nebraska Act. And the fact that here was a departure from the ways that people had been thinking about approaching this issue of slavery extension in the past. And leading up to this, it was the Congress who had was attempting to mandate, you know, to pass a sort of a law that says this place will be free, this place will be slave. What happens here is that we shift over to a principle that says, well, we will let the people who live in these places decide, which is very different than what had gone before. Why at that point do we turn to popular sovereignty and turn against this idea that we'll let the Congress decide?
That's a good question. Now we get to talk about some Illinois politicians. Because Stephen Douglas, the Democratic senator from Illinois, was very much involved in this episode, and as it's long been well known, the passage of this act is what brings Abraham Lincoln back into politics in opposition to it. You misstated slightly, however, that the doctrine of popular sovereignty had originally been advanced by Democrats as early as 1847, when they saw their party split along sectional lines by the Wilmot Proviso. This was an alternative. Just let the people of the territories decide, take the action out of the hands of Congress. The Democratic candidate the presidential election of 1848, Lewis Cass was strongly committed to popular sovereignty. Cass's nomination is what helped provoke the formation of the Free Soil Party, whose platform was that no, we need the Wilmot Proviso, congressional prohibition. Stephen Douglas was an advocate of popular sovereignty. And in a piece of legislation we've jumped over, the Compromise of 1850, in the territorial provisions of that package of laws, that is, formally organizing territories in New Mexico and Utah, popular sovereignty was applied in two ways. There was a provision, a very interesting provision, that says any states formed out of these territories shall be, that is, must be, admitted by future Congresses with or without slavery as their constitutions prescribe at the time they seek statehood. That is, this is tying the hands of future Congresses to force them to accept more slave states if the people wanted it. But other provisions allowed the territorial legislatures to decide on slavery. Douglas, in the end, managed the passage of the compromise bills in the Senate after Henry Clay broke down of physical exhaustion and went off to Newport, Rhode Island. And Douglas, because he was the chairman of the Senate's Committee on Territories, is involved in writing the bills for Kansas and Nebraska. He'd long wanted to organize that area west of Iowa and Missouri, but the problem had been this Missouri Compromise line, and Southern Democratic senators said, we won't allow you to organize any territories there unless we can take slaves in there. So Douglas tried to find a way around the prohibition, forever prohibited, the language of the Missouri Compromise, by saying that the popular sovereignty provisions of the Utah and New Mexico bills in 1850 had in fact been meant by members of Congress to apply to all territories, not just to Utah and New Mexico, that is, to the northern part of the Louisiana Territory as well. This was a sheer lie. I mean, this was a flat-out lie that members of Congress had intended to do that in 1850. But he used this specious argument to justify getting rid of the 3630 line prohibition. He wrote language that said it is an inoperative and void because it contradicts the popular sovereignty provisions of the Compromise of 1850. So it's Popular sovereignty is a doctrine that emerges in the late 1840s to tie the Democratic Party together that had been split along sectional lines by the Wilmot Proviso. It's included in the laws, the territorial provisions of the Compromise of 1850, and then Douglas uses that provision to justify overturning the 3630 prohibition in the Kansas-Nebraska Act. It's the Kansas-Nebraska Act, in turn, once it's passed, and from then on, arguably, the Civil War is unavoidable, because the Kansas Northern anger at the Kansas-Nebraska Act is what leads directly to the creation of the Republican Party, bringing anti-slavery Democrats and anti-slavery Whigs and former Free Soilers together into a new combination. It takes Lincoln a while to join that party. He runs for the state legislature as a Whig in 1854, but by late 1855, he sees the writing on the wall, and he's ready to join that new organization.
Well, we are at the point where we're going to have to stop because we've used the time.
I feel like a filibuster. I didn't mean to take all the time.
No, that's fine. That's fine. That's what we hope for. We hope to learn something now and again here on this program. We very appreciate very much you giving us some of your time today.
Okay, I've enjoyed being here.
Our guest, Michael Holt, he teaches history at University of Virginia. And if you'd like to read more on the subject, and there indeed is more to be said, you can look for his book, The Fate of Their Country, Politicians, Slavery Extension, and the Coming of the Civil War. It's published by Hill and Wang. Our program, Focus 580, made possible by a grant from Bodywork Associates this year, celebrating their 22nd anniversary. Bodywork Associates has been providing professional massage therapy to Champaign-Urbana since 1982. Also, the broadcast is made possible by a grant from The Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign. The staff there at The Great Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting public radio. And once again, before we go, just a reminder that coming up on the program on Monday, Dr. Suzanne Truppen will be our guest. She is an obstetrician and a gynecologist and is also on the faculty at the U of I Med School here in Urbana-Champaign. And once a month is on the show, we talk about women's health. Then in the second part of the program, we'll talk with David Owen, writer from The New Yorker, about his book Copies in Seconds. It's about Chester Carlson, the man who invented the Xerox machine. That's Hour 2 Monday. We hope you'll stay tuned because coming up next is the Afternoon Magazine. Celeste Quinn is the host.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine, a discussion about deceit, lying, and falsehoods. Our guest will be philosopher and psychologist David Livingstone Smith, author of Why We Lie. That follows the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look now.